From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we're going to have a conversation with journalist and best-selling author Andrew Solomon. Solomon is giving a lecture this evening as part of the University of Utah's Tanner Lectures on Human Values. We'll speak about his most recent book, Far From the Tree, that looks at how families work to accept children with physical, mental, and social disabilities, or, as Solomon puts it, who have horizontal identities.
And what I found is that most of those horizontal identities are things that people have tried time out of mind to cure. And I'm very interested in the ways in which people manage to move from an experience of their difference as an illness to their experience of that difference as an identity.
That conversation and your summary of today's top local headlines coming up ahead on The Rundown. First up, though, these messages and Access Downtown. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll have a conversation with best-selling author and journalist Andrew Solomon about his new book, Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. But first up, we have these local headlines. A small city in northern Utah will vote Tuesday whether to get rid of its long-standing rule banning alcohol sales. Hyde Park, population 4,000, is among a handful of dry cities left in a state known for its teetotaling ways. If voters pass the ordinance, it would open the door for the city's only convenience store to sell 3.2% alcohol content beer. Residents would still have to drive about 5 miles to get hard alcohol and heavier beer in Logan at the nearest state-run liquor store. The proposal has divided the conservative, mostly Mormon town, with some city council members arguing that the town shouldn't allow the sale of any mind-altering substances. Backers say lifting the ban won't corrupt the city's children and that it will bring in more sales tax revenue. Industrialist and philanthropist John Huntsman Sr. has denied a claim in a new book that he was the source of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's assertion last year that Mitt Romney had not paid taxes in a decade. According to the book Double Down by journalists Mark Halperin and John Heilemann, Reid told President Barack Obama's team during the presidential election that the source for the claim was Huntsman. He's the father of John Huntsman Jr., one of Romney's 2012 primary opponents. But the elder Huntsman told the Salt Lake Tribune that the allegation is completely false and that the book is, quote, supermarket tabloid trash. He told KTVX-TV in Salt Lake City that he has never known anything about Romney's tax returns and that he never talked to Reid about them. The authors declined to comment on Sunday. Last year, the elder Huntsman also denied he was Reid's source for the story. A judge has overturned a plan for managing public lands in central Utah that opened more than 4,200 miles of dirt roads and trails to motorized use. U.S. District Judge Dale Kimball ruled on Monday that a U.S. land management agency failed to consider how vehicles might damage archaeological sites. The ruling sends the Richfield District plan back to the Bureau of Land Management. The Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and other environmental groups hailed the decision. They say it's the first land use plan prepared by the former administration of President George W. Bush to be struck down in Utah. The Bush administration developed 6 plans guiding the use of Utah's public rangelands, from oil and gas drilling to all-terrain vehicle use. And finally today, law enforcement officials say they've arrested 2 California men who spent thousands of dollars using stolen or fraudulent credit cards. The Orem Department of Public Safety says officers received calls last Thursday from Best Music in Orem after clerks reported a fraudulent credit card was used to purchase $10,000 worth of guitars. Police say soon after, they received a call from Summerhays Music Store, also in Orem, about a customer behaving suspiciously. The officers arrested 33-year-old Mark Martinez. Officials say Martinez led police to a Springville hotel, where they also arrested 24-year-old Robert Richardson. Police say they found $20,000 worth of stolen merchandise, a machine to make credit cards, and other equipment. Both men are being held in the Utah County Jail on multiple charges related to fraud, forgery, and stolen property. And that's our local news summary for the day. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. Stay with us. Now on the program, we're going to turn to a conversation with best-selling author and journalist Andrew Solomon, who writes on politics, culture, and psychology. Solomon is in Salt Lake City to give a lecture this evening as part of the Tanner Humanities Center's lecture series on human values. Andrew Solomon, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So your lecture this evening is entitled Love, Acceptance, Celebration, How Parents Make Their Children. This is the result of extensive research you did for your most recent book called Far From the Tree. And that award-winning book looks at families with children who are exceptional, children with what you call horizontal identities. And that's where I'd like to start. For our listening audience, would you mind defining that term, horizontal identity?
Yes. I've proposed that identities fall into two categories. There are vertical identities that get passed down generationally, one's ethnicity, one's nationality, frequently one's religion. These are all things that children are likely to have in common with their parents. And while some of them may be challenging in various contexts, nobody has ever proposed trying to cure them. You can argue, our current presidency notwithstanding, that it's still easier in the United States of America to be white. But there's nobody doing research into how to ensure that the next generation of children born to African-American or Asian parents come out with creamy skin and blue eyes and yellow hair. Then there are the identities that you don't have in common with your parents. So most gay children are born to straight parents. Most deaf children are born to hearing parents. Most dwarfs are born to parents of full height. Most people with autism are born to non-autistic parents, and so on and so forth. These are identities that you have to learn from a peer group, which is why I've called them horizontal, because they don't come down in that descent lineage. They're discovered in your own contemporaries or the own world that you discover. And what I found is that most of those horizontal identities are things that people have tried time out of mind to cure, and I'm very interested in the ways in which people manage to move from an experience of their difference as an illness to their experience of that difference as an identity.
You write that you have created a how-to manual for receptivity, a description of how to tolerate what cannot be cured, and an argument that cures are not always appropriate, even when they are feasible. That is, to some extent, a radical thought, especially the latter part of it, that sometimes, quote, curing a, quote, disability isn't maybe the right choice?
I think we narrow the human experience at our own peril. The world is made richer, more interesting by having a broad variety of people in it. And the implication behind some of the medical work that's been done in the field of disability is that actually what we should be trying to do is to create a standardized world in which everyone has many of the same characteristics. Any of the conditions that I've looked at comes both with problems which are inherent to it. You know, if you have physical disabilities that are acutely physically painful, they're physically painful. If you have those physical disabilities and they make it impossible for you to get into the library because there's no ramp there, the ramp is something that can be addressed. The physical pain is something that is inherent. So we have to think through when we talk about curing things, whether when we do so, what we're doing is narrowing human experience. I think it's appropriate to try to resolve all of the pain which is actually endemic to the conditions. And it's perhaps appropriate to accommodate some of the differences which are ultimately more tolerable. I mean, I grew up in an era in which being gay was considered an illness. And in my adult life, it's an identity. And it would make me sad, and I think it would be a loss to the world if all of the gay people got cured. I met, when I went out into the deaf world, many people who had a strong sense of cultural identity as deaf people. They felt that they belonged to a linguistic subculture rather than to a disability group. There are arguments to be made on both sides. I myself wouldn't want to become deaf at this point, but I understood when I spent time with deaf people in their world why they felt that way. And some of the autism advocates have been very outspoken. One of them, whom I'm fond of quoting, said, "When parents say, 'I wish my child did not have autism,' what they're really saying is, 'I wish the autistic child I have did not exist, and I had a different non-autistic child instead.' Read that again. This is what we hear when you mourn over our existence. This is what we know when you pray for a cure, that your fondest hope and dream is that someday we will cease to be, and strangers you can love will move in behind our faces."
I mean, that's a very powerful statement, and it's kind of a cry for recognition or for rights even at the same time. You write about these horizontal identities from a cultural standpoint, that they are distinctly different but also parallel or even unifying. How does that unification occur, and do these people of distinct, you know, of distinct worlds, be they autistic or deaf or people who have dwarfism, Do they recognize that unification, or what's the story there?
I decided in this book to look at a variety of kinds of difference that occur. Situations, horizontal identities in which children have conditions that their parents don't share. I looked at deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, multiple severe disabilities. I looked at prodigies whose families are also quite overwhelmed. So I wanted to illustrate the point that what's difficult is difference rather than the positive or negative valence of that difference. I looked at women bringing up children conceived in rape because those families too are facing a challenge to the ordinary laws of parental affection, and the mothers have to struggle with discomfort with the child they've produced, much as some of these other mothers do. I wrote about families of people who commit crimes because I wanted to make the point that this complexity of relationship can be a result not only of who your child is, but also of what your child does. And I looked at families of people who are transgender, because I think families of people who are transgender have a very high rate of rejecting those children, and yet there are stories of heroic love in the face of it. And the underlying argument of the book is that while each of these conditions individually is quite isolating, there are only so many families dealing with schizophrenia, only so many dealing with autism, only so many dealing with kids who are transgender. If one considers that all of these families, you have families that perceive themselves to be somehow normal, if you'll allow that word, with children whom they perceive to be not so normal, and that experience is a common one, then it turns out it's something that an enormous number of people have in common. And I really wanted to propose that difference is what unites us, that those differences are, in fact, the very things that hold people together, and that actually pretty much all parenting involves the recognition of difference at some level or other. I have yet to meet any parent who doesn't some of the time look at his child and think that my child is an alien from outer space. Everyone is brooking those differences. And really, once you recognize that, you realize that what these families are going through is something they have in common with most of humanity.
And the first line of your book actually is there is no such thing as reproduction. Basically, what you're saying is that reproduction is a misnomer because it implies a kind of copying when that is by no means what being a parent entails. I want to talk about those parents and a line of balance that you touch on a bit. You say that most of the parents you interviewed say they would never want other children than the ones they had. But there's an underlying comment on acceptance there, a kind of tension between acceptance and love.
Love should ideally be present from the time a child is born. And while we all hear stories of horrific abuse and neglect and so on, my experience is that by and large, most people love their children. That's the sort of natural course of things. Acceptance is something that takes a long time and is very gradually negotiated. And I think a lot of the time, children who experience deficits in acceptance experience them as deficits in love. I felt when my parents initially struggled with the news that I was gay that they didn't love me enough. And in retrospect, I realized they always loved me enormously. They just were struggling to accept me. And acceptance takes time, and it takes everyone time. And my parents didn't take so long about it compared to many others. And as I went deeper and deeper into the work on this book, I found over and over again that there were parents who would say, I love my child, but I don't understand this world that he's become part of. He's gone off into a whole signing deaf culture, and I feel alienated from it. Or they would say, I love my child, but because I love my child, I'm trying to cure his autism, and he seems not to want that to happen, and he's resisting it. There were all these cross purposes that came through there. Now, parenthood essentially involves doing two things. It involves, on the one hand, changing your children. We don't let our children grow up as wild things. That would be neglect. We try to teach them manners. We try to teach them values. We try to teach them beliefs. We try to teach them all kinds of things. That's what it means to be a parent. We correct them when they err. We do all kinds of things to change the way they function. But the other part of parenting is to recognize who your child truly is and to help your child to feel good about who he truly is. And there are some things that obviously need to be accepted, and there are some things that obviously need to be changed. And there's a heck of a lot that falls in the middle somewhere, and people don't know how much they need to accept something, how much they need to change it, what the balance is in there. And I found that a lot of parents, even loving ones, weren't sure where it was appropriate to exercise acceptance and where it wasn't.
Well, and I imagine that especially in the cases where your day-to-day existence is maybe a harder thing to navigate, if you struggle with a developmental disorder or a mental illness or a genetic disease, for example, that it would be very difficult not to say this person's life could be improved. But you're not necessarily saying that efforts to improve people's lives should be halted all at once, right?
I certainly am not opposed to the medical progress that we're making in the treatment of many of these conditions. I think it's absolutely fantastic that there's medical progress, and I think it's fantastic that there's a social progress toward accepting these conditions to a greater degree. Now, if you have someone, for instance, who has Down syndrome, I've met parents who've said, I love my child as who he is. The personality he has is because he has Down syndrome. I would never want to change him. And I've met parents who've said, look, having Down syndrome is not so easy. It gives him a difficult life. I worry about what will happen after I'm gone. And if I possibly could get him not to have Down syndrome so that he could live more independently, that's what I choose to do. I have great respect for both of those points of view, and I think each of them has its validities. What I think is a problem is when you get a society which is structured so that everyone feels as though Down syndrome is a completely undesirable thing. People with Down syndrome need to be cured or fixed. And if you can't really cure or fix them, you have to experience them permanently as broken or deficient. I don't think that's helpful to the society at large. I don't think it's helpful to people with Down syndrome. I don't think it's helpful to the parents of people with Down syndrome. So what I would say is if you can alleviate pain and suffering someone's going through, of course, there's plenty of pain in the world. There's no need to preserve any of it unnecessarily. But if the way that you go about trying to come up with a cure is by undermining the sense of validity that there is in the lives of people who otherwise might have a feeling of purposefulness, either the people affected or their families, then that I think is a disservice to the society.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting concept. Andrew, in the interest of time, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind telling us the story of Tom and Karen Robards. Earlier, you were talking about aspects of parenting, and it seems to me that the transformation that that befalls them as a result of having a child with Down syndrome is kind of emblematic of the kinds of transformations you depict in your book.
I am very fond of Tom and Karen Robards. In fact, I saw Karen Robards just a couple of days ago, and we were talking about that story again. They were hard-charging Wall Street types when their first son was born. They were shocked that he had Down syndrome. They were young. They were healthy themselves. They didn't know what to do about it. They tried their best to take care of him. And then as it came time for him to enter the school system, they really were discontent with the educational opportunities that were available to him. And so they banded together with two other families, and they decided to found a learning center for their children. Just with the three children, the three families, they got the Archdiocese of New York, because they were all Catholic families, to give them an unused public lavatory that they converted into a classroom. And they began something which has since grown into the Cook Center, which has now educated untold thousands of people with intellectual disabilities. And it became their life's work to build this thing up and to make it a vital and vibrant and effective educating institution. And the advances in the education of people with Down syndrome over the last 40 years have utterly transformed life for people with DS, some of whom are now actors, some of whom are now poets, some of whom are now living independently. It's really amazing how different things are now than they were then. And I said to them, do you regret it? Do you wish that you'd never heard of Down syndrome? Do you wish your son didn't have it? And Tom Robards said, well, for our son David, I wish that he didn't have it, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world, and I'd like to make his life easier. But in a larger sense, I think if all the people with Down syndrome disappeared from the world, it would be a real loss to humanity. So the personal wish and the social wish are not completely aligned. And Karen Robards said, I'm with Tom. If I could change it for David, I would, because I think David struggles a great deal. But speaking for myself, I've grown so much. I've had so much more purposeful a life. I've done things that are so much more important and meaningful than I would ever have done otherwise, that speaking for myself, while I would never have believed 23 years ago when he was born that I could come to such a point, speaking for myself, I wouldn't exchange these experiences for anything in the world.
And that transformation is one of many that you depict in this massive book. The book is 700 pages long, and it must have been a pretty serious endeavor. And this is a question I guess I could ask any author, but I'm wondering if you could maybe explain to us, why did you set out to write this book? How did that happen?
20 years ago, my editors at the New York Times Magazine asked me to write a piece about deaf culture. And I was somewhat taken aback by the assignment at the time, A, because I didn't know there was such a thing as deaf culture, and B, because I had mostly been doing foreign reporting for the Times. And my editor said, this is a foreign culture in our own midst. And I went out into the deaf world and I began going to the deaf theater and going to deaf clubs. I went to the meetings of the National Association of the Deaf. I went to the Miss Deaf America contest in Nashville, Tennessee, where people complained about that slurry Southern signing. I did a whole series of experiences in that deaf world. And as I engaged with that deaf world, I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, that those parents, by and large, try to make them function in the hearing world, and that those deaf kids often discover deaf culture in adolescence when it comes as a great liberation. And so I had the experience with them, and I thought how similar it was to my own experience as a gay person. And then a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf. And when her daughter was born, she suddenly began asking all these questions. Should I tell her she's the same as everyone else, only a little shorter? Should I somehow ask her to develop an awareness of dwarfism as a culture? Do I have to join the little people of America? And I thought, here it is again. Here it is, this problem again of the person who really, in some sense, thinks of herself as normal with a child whom she thinks of as different. And I thought at that point, how do we all manage to deal with these identities, and how do all of these families manage to deal with us? And I thought if I had found common cause with deaf people and with dwarfs, there must be others. And I also thought, I'm very lucky to have lived in an era in which the difference I have has emerged as a relatively socially acceptable one, has received a sort of backing from various parts of government. I've been in a time of enormous change. And there's a tendency for people who have just won their civil rights to ally themselves very closely with the people who have gone before. So a lot of the leaders of the gay rights movement have aligned themselves with members of the African-American civil rights movement, or even with the women's movement. And I thought, instead of reaching toward the people who have already gotten to where we're headed, what about reaching to the people who might come next and offering them a hand over the ravine? And that was really the feeling with which I went forth.
Well, Andrew Solomon, it's a fascinating work, but we're out of time, and unfortunately we can't continue talking about it. But we appreciate your coming onto the program today and look forward to your lecture this evening.
It's been a tremendous pleasure. Thank you so much.
Andrew Solomon is a best-selling author and journalist. He's giving this evening's Tanner Lecture on Human Values at the University of Utah Union Ballroom. That's tonight at 7 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. KCPW will also be airing that lecture on Friday at 10 a.m. and 8 p.m. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And that's full time for The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for an Election Day conversation about Real Women Run, an initiative to try and get more women to run for public office. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.